The people we hire have to buy into the ethos. Now, does that mean they have to be Bitcoiners? They typically are. If they're not Bitcoiners, then they probably have to be, they have to be like completely disassociated from everything else in crypto or whatever.
Welcome to the Bitcoin Talent Co. podcast, where we interview entry-level to C-level executives about working in the Bitcoin industry. Learn about their interview process, what they do day-to-day at their Bitcoin job, and advice for current job seekers looking to work full-time in Bitcoin. Hope you enjoy.
Hello and welcome to the Bitcoin Talent Co. podcast. I'm your host, Eric Podwatchke, and today I'm joined by my friend Bob Burnett, who is the founder and CEO of Barefoot Mining. Bob, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me, Eric.
Yeah, sure thing. So let's jump right into it here. Before this whole Bitcoin thing, started taking over your life, what were you doing before professionally?
Yeah, well, as an older guy, I have a pretty long runway to get to Bitcoin, but most of my career was in the personal computer industry. So I started working with personal computers in about 1979, which I know was probably before almost everybody listening to this was born. And so I went to school for computer engineering. It was kind of a blend of computer science and electrical engineering. And then in 1986, I went to work for a company called Zenith. This was just out of college after graduating, and was on the design team of junior member, don't want to overstate my role, but of what I would consider to be the world's first laptop computer.
Wow.
So it was a very exciting time, to the degree it's pertinent. We can talk about it a little bit later, but the personal computer industry in 1986 was just getting started. The IBM AT, which is kind of the computer that was the cornerstone of the personal computer industry, had been released in 1984. And so in 86, we were bringing mobile computing kind of to light to the first time. And Zenith in the mid to late 80s was the largest laptop maker in the world. Obviously, we created what I consider to be that category. And I spent 6 years there, then left with a couple other people. Mainly because we saw a direction for mobile computing that was different from, we were working in a Fortune 500 company, and the sales channel and the marketing folks there had a different vision for mobile computing. It's very common in technology companies that when something finds success, they tend to kind of want to recreate the same thing over and over again, maybe make it cheaper. Because that's, and I don't mean to be demeaning to salespeople, but a lot of times people would say, well, if this, like in this era, if the laptop was $4,000, if you could just make it so that it was $3,000, I could sell a whole bunch more. And then if, oh, it was $3,000, now if you can make it $2,500, I'll sell a whole bunch more. So there's this propensity to stop innovating. Like you find a certain success, now stop innovating, but make it cheaper. And it's why, like Steve Jobs, and I come from the same mode. Like he didn't believe in things like focus group studies, because this is true of consumers too. Consumers can't typically envision where technology is going and how it's going to change their life. And this comes back to Bitcoin, and we'll kind of relate it back to Bitcoin. They can't envision these things, and so they look through the lens of today and how they use the product or they interact with the service, whatever it is, and then they can't apply it. And we were seeing the same thing. So I left because we saw the world was not at that time trying to go cheaper, but we saw we could make them much smaller, much lighter, much better battery life. We were focused on those sort of things. So we left, we did a startup. We got funding from the Japanese, from Mitsui, which was the second biggest company in the world at the time. and Sanyo, and we created a new class of mobile computing, which was called the Subnotebook. It's like a 2.2-pound ran Windows sort of thing. And we didn't have the money as a startup. We were well-funded. We had about a $15 million raise, but we didn't have the money to not create the product and build all the infrastructure of a company, like sales team, support team, customer service. Like, there's all these things that you have to put in place. And we didn't have the money or the time to do that. So what we did is we went out and shopped the product to major computer brands, and we're fortunate that Gateway bought it. Again, those of you who are younger, Gateway was one of the biggest PC companies in the world in the 90s and 2000s. And although at that time, which would have been 1991, 92, they were just kind of at the beginning of their meteoric rise. So anyway, they bought the product. Shortly after that, they bought the company and me and everything. And so I went to Gateway. This was just before Gateway went public. So I was fortunate to become part of the management team that helped take Gateway public. And then through a whole series of events, I became the chief technical officer there. So I led all the product development, desktops and servers and laptops, and we did TVs and MP3 players and digital cameras. So it was a wonderful experience. And then I ran Gateway International as well. So I ran all the overseas businesses for Gateway for a few years, and then left and did a technology incubator for about 10 years. Then I found Bitcoin in 2017.
Okay. Yeah, we'll definitely dive more into Bitcoin. I'm curious though about, so you're a technical person, right? Did you always know that you wanted to be more of like an entrepreneur running companies, or were you planning on being more on the technical side for your career? And I guess what led you to be more of an entrepreneur and go to the business side of things?
Hey guys, real quick, as a Bitcoin-focused recruiting firm, our goal at Bitcoin Talent Co. is to bring as many professionals into the Bitcoin industry as possible. Since we don't run ads, our one ask is to rate, review, and share this podcast with friends and family so more people can find this show. Thanks, and now back to the interview.
That's a great question. You know, I started as a technical person, and my original dream... Oh, geez. Sorry. My original dream was if you go way back, like my inspiration, I'm so old that, you know, I was a young boy watching the rocket go to the moon for the first time. So I was inspired by that. That was like, you know, I want to be an astronaut. I want to build rockets. I want to do that sort of thing. You know, that sort of thing, reading science fiction books, all that. I wanted to do something with technology, and I wanted to be part of something really big. Mm-hmm. So it led me as I originally was thinking about getting out of, when I get out of school and I started looking for jobs, I didn't realize I was an entrepreneur. I wanted to associate myself with these big projects, and I thought I had to go work for a big company. So, I was interviewing with big defense contractors and computer companies, and you know, companies that were doing these like big sort of things. Like, I went to school in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and so. General Electric was there, and I remember interviewing in their division that was doing the MRI machines at the time. You know, so it was like that sort of thing that was thrilling to me. And it wasn't until I got in, I was blessed to be part of this really cool design. Like I said, to be part of the first laptop computer is a pretty cool thing. But then I started to realize that I had this like battle. Like, I had this vision for technology, but the power structure of the company didn't put me in a position of power. Mm-hmm. And so, and not just me, but I think a lot of the technical talent, this happens a lot where a technology company finds its birth from the technologists and the engineers and the ideas to create this thing. Mm-hmm. And then it hits a certain level and the finance people and the sales people kind of often take over positions of power within the structure. Mm-hmm. And they start squishing the innovative forces that are coming out of a different path. And so there's this fight, you know, and you see it in Fortune 500 companies. And so the successful ones, you know, like we use Apple as an example. Apple, mainly in the Jobs era, in the second Jobs era, said, no, I will not squish that innovation, right? And he let it kind of go. And I was blessed when I was at Gateway, the founder and CEO of Gateway, a guy named Ted Waite, he believed in me and he believed in his own gut too. Like, so we would, if we were deciding to build a new product, he would kind of defer more to the innovators and the technologists, and he would trust his own gut, which often was contrary to what the conventional thinking was. Mm-hmm. Right. And it was very successful. So, I was fortunate to be able to be an entrepreneur within a Fortune. So Gateway became a Fortune 200 company and I was the CTO, and I had enough power that I could be an entrepreneur within that setup, which by the way is ideal because in certain ways, because now you have, whether it's legal teams or finance teams or, you know, whatever that maybe have to support you. They're there to support and relieve the person being the entrepreneur or the innovator. Sure. Yeah. From these other burdens. Because one of the things you learn when you're on your own is that you may have a great idea. You may be, whether you're a coder or you're a hardware person, you know, whatever, but you quickly find some of the things that you talk about. Well, you have to hire people, you have to have insurance for the company, you have to have an accounting system, you have to have a phone system, you have to all those things are pulling you away from creating the product or the service, you know, and as the company grows, that becomes a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think there's a great book. It's an older book. It's called Crossing the Chasm. And it talks about, it was what I lived in this era of the 80s and 90s, and the 80s and 90s especially. You know, why did a lot of companies go through this period from nothing to meteoric success to failure? Like, what? Or failure or stagnation, at least. You know, why does that happen? And a big reason that it happens is that in the early days, let's say, you know, you and I, Eric, we decide we have a great idea. So I'm going to be the technology guy and production guy. You're gonna do all the business development, sales, and marketing, right? So mm-hmm. we have this really kind of easy division of labor, and one of you, either you or me, have to do everything. And you're probably my backup and I'm your backup. Like, it's a very simple structure. And so we come up with this idea and we get it out in the world and the world reacts to it in a positive way. So you say, well, I need three salespeople and I need an HR person now and I need this and I need that. And, you know, I need more engineers. I need a procurement person. I need whatever. The company hits a certain stage. I'll use people in this context. It could be revenue, it could be number of units sold, it could be number of people, but let's say we hit 10 people and go, well, in the past, when something when, let's say, a new order would come in, you'd get the order and you'd tell me, Bob, I need 10, and I would go get them built, right? Now we got 10 people. And so you just telling me to do this, and maybe 6 times a day you tell me 8 for this guy, 4 for this guy, 12 for this guy. That system breaks down, right? So the company has to develop some structure. And eventually, it might be at 10 people, it might be at 50 people, it might be at 100 people. If we haven't put in well-defined processes to track orders and confirm shipments and do all these other things, the company will fail. But that also means you and I no longer know everything that's going on. We have to delegate, we have to do all these things. And it turns out that a lot of founders and creators suffer from, you call it narcissism, megalomaniac, micromanaging, whatever you want to call it. Sure. They are not capable of themselves delegating. That's a big problem. And the other problem is that, then this is the really hard one. Let's say you and I did that, and then you went and hired somebody that to be the head of sales, okay? And it's a first sales guy, right? And they're very successful, and they bring a bunch of business in. And then you hire 4 more salespeople. And at some point, you have this big sales team, and somebody has to be the sales leader. And maybe that person who was the original salesperson and is still very important to the organization and doing a great job isn't the best candidate.
Hmm.
And maybe even have to bring in a new person because, you know, while they may be successful here, you want the company to be over here and you know that they're not there yet. And that's a really, really hard thing. But these things break companies down, right? They create. And then even if you do that, that person, that salesperson, that original salesperson, they might stick with you, but now they're disgruntled. Now you start seeing this cultural rift occur. And, you know, so I've lived this a lot of times, and I'm probably way off the beaten path of what you wanted to talk about. But
that's good.
But you know, because you asked me about entrepreneurship. But
I could talk about entrepreneurship all day.
Yeah. But I think this is part of it, right? This is part of it. Like, how do you create an organization and how do you lead an organization and these sort of things? And this is the shit it's the non-glamorous stuff, you know, but it turns out, and it goes back to that book, why do companies fail? Why do so many that find some success for a while then fail? It's because they can't continue to adapt and evolve. And a lot of times the people, because if the company, like I said, it'll go back to that, say you have a 10-person company that is doing well, if the company is going to quadruple in size in the space of a year, do those 10 people have the capacity to grow themselves from being successful in the company from where it is today to one that's 4 times as big? It doesn't mean they're bad, but, you know, sometimes people just can't learn and grow at the same rate that the company has potential.
Sure.
Yeah. And that's really a hard thing to deal with. And then handled improperly, it implodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's actually super relevant to this podcast today, because a lot of these Bitcoin companies nowadays, they're startups, they're technology startups. And then you see what happens when they start scaling and hiring out that head of sales, whoever it may be. Yeah, they do stop innovating in a way, and they lose their progress and growth. So, yeah, anyone listening that's running a Bitcoin company right now, take Bob's advice here on that.
Yeah.
Let's jump over to the Bitcoin side of things. So you said 2017... you got into Bitcoin. Give me the full Bitcoin story and how you got to today with Barefoot Mining.
Yeah. Okay. So I came in through the back door like a lot of people. I have it starts in the shitcoin world, but Same in a answer. different in a different sort of way. So I was a backup piece of it. So back the clock up to the early 90s. In the early 90s, Gateway was, we were a several hundred million dollar company on our way to being a multi-billion dollar company, Fortune 200 company. But we, in the early 90s, got a knock on the door one day from a startup company called NVIDIA.
Oh, wow.
And we were the very first company to design NVIDIA silicon into a computer. So their first customer, in other words, their first customer. So me and Keith Thomas, who's the president of Barefoot Mining and was also the head of desktop engineering at Gateway, played a key role in that. So anyway, 2017, one day, I was sitting at home. It was an evening, about 9 o'clock, and my phone rang. It was a Seattle phone number, one I did not recognize, but it came up, you know, Seattle. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to answer it, like probably a lot of people, right? Some, and my wife, who's, she's very instinctual. I said, oh, like I held up my phone, like, hey, you know, this is from Seattle. She said, answer it. I don't want to answer it. It's like, we're watching a movie at 9 o'clock and there's I don't want to answer it. So I did. Well, it turns out it was an ex Gateway person. I hadn't talked to him in a decade or more. He said, Bob, do you remember me? I did. He said, I'm working on a project and we need 300 Ethereum mining servers, each with 8 NVIDIA. At the time, it was a 1070 GPU. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of horsepower, you know. And I said, well, okay. He said, I can't get the chips and nobody can build these things in a professional manner. People were, at the time, those of you who've been around a while, people would build mining equipment. Like they would take, they would go buy like wire shoe racks from Walmart and strap motherboards and graphics cards and power supplies to these things. And they didn't work particularly well. They maybe were not even particularly safe. And if you wanted 300 of those that you were going to run in a professional manner, it wasn't going to work. And I said, well, I'm surprised Dell or HP or somebody can't build them for you. He said, no, they won't touch it. And I was in this kind of weird spot of, it was a big order. You wanted millions of dollars of this stuff, but it wasn't enough to make a major PC company excited. Mm-hmm. So he said, you know, can you get the chips and can you build them for me? So I basically said, okay, give me a day. So Keith, who I mentioned before, and I got together the next morning. We talked about it. We picked up the phone. We called NVIDIA and said, do you guys remember us? And they did. And we said, we're thinking of doing this. Will you support us? And they said, yes. This is at a time when those chips were like really in tight supply. So we put together a design really quickly, had graphics cards made, a specific mining-based graphics card for that order, and we fulfilled the order and was very successful. I said, I think they were, I don't know, they were $6,000-something dollars each. So it was like a, you know, we went from the phone call to delivering the product. I think it was like 4.5 weeks. And it was like a $2 million order. So it was pretty cool thing. And then we started going to other people and said, hey, we designed this thing. We could build more. Would anybody else like one? And we got a pretty good response. This was in 2017. So for those of you, you know, there's a lot of hoopla around the whole cryptocurrency area at the time.
I remember. Yep.
So we got a lot of people saying yes, but almost everybody that said yes after the first customer said yes, but I'll only do it if you will host it for me, if you'll run it. So it forced us to go from, we were just computer guys selling computers. That's how we started, right? That's how we viewed it. And then like, oh, now you have to host these things. Well, then we looked at the return, and like they're actually doing really, really well. So we took the profits we were making selling the computers and hosting and started buying our own equipment. But then I finally had a chance to breathe. This is a very rapid thing. I finally had a chance to breathe. I didn't mention, I also have a degree in economics. It's not a big deal. But I had studied Austrian economics after college as well, and I found Austrian economics in like 2002. There's a whole reason why I did. And then I started peeling back the onion of Ethereum, started feeling uncomfortable technically with it. The complexity of it, the governance, the centralization. At the time, hey, we're going to move away from proof of work. All these sort of things started being red flag, red flag, red flag. I dug deeper into Bitcoin. Started to see what I liked. We started to pivot the company away from Ethereum and toward Bitcoin. We would have loved to design our own ASIC. And by that, I'm talking about the chip itself. You know, we would have loved to have designed that, but people probably don't understand this, but you know, it costs about $20 million to bring an ASIC to market today. That's about what it would cost. And that's before committing to inventory. Mm-hmm. So that's just, it's not that complex of a logic design to create the SHA-256. A chip to do that is not like super hard, but the process of working with TMC, TSMC or Samsung, which are the only two places in the world that really could build it today. Intel's still hopefully coming online, but to go through the prototyping stage and get the masks and get ready to do wafer starts and all that, about $20 million. And then you have to pay for the chips. So anyway, that was not going to happen for us. So we did the next best thing, which was we went to a company called Bitfury, which is largest European. I think today still the largest European maker of equipment. We signed a deal with them to become the US distributor and service provider for Bitfury equipment. We still have that deal today, by the way. So they're not a major supplier in the industry, but they still exist and they still produce product, and there's some advantages of their product over Bitmain and MicroBT in certain situations. So then we started going down that path. And we, you know, reselling their equipment. We also, you know, work with Bitmain and MicroBT too. Started expanding our hosting. We started doing a lot more self mining. That's probably our main thing now, is we do a lot more self mining than hosting. We've tried to been a big advocate for the development of small to medium sized commercial sites, which I call horse class mining. Okay. And you know, we feel it's the most, feel it's critical to a healthy and robust Bitcoin ecosystem that exists. So we think we can make money at it too, obviously. So
got it. Okay. Let's dive more into the company itself. So you mentioned hosting, mining for yourselves, plus maybe investing in some new projects. Yeah. What are you guys all involved in right now? What's the core business units of Barefoot Mining?
Well, here's the way that we operate. And that'll probably give you the insight you want. So what we basically do now is, in mining, almost everything starts with energy. That shouldn't be a surprise. If you're listening to this, you're probably a Bitcoiner. You know, everything starts with energy. So we're constantly looking to identify sources of energy that are obviously economically advantageous in what we call a friendly jurisdiction. Yes. So as an example, a great deal in energy in San Jose or New York City is not interesting to us. It doesn't exist, by the way, but even if it did, it wouldn't be interesting to us because it's in the wrong place.
Right.
And we would feel threatened. We design our sites with the expectation that we're going to be there for a long time, a couple decades or more. So we don't want to go to a place where we might get kicked out or the people don't want us there. Mm-hmm. Okay. So anyway, we identify the energy source. Then we pair that with a technical solution based on what type of energy and where it is and the climate and those sort of things. So
yeah, like the conversion to electricity.
Well, we're going to use these kind of containers. We're going to use these mining servers.
Got it.
Like that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Then once we have that in place, what we typically do today, unless we can 100% fund the site ourselves, then what we do is we will create a unique legal entity for that project. Like we just announced one last week called West Bay Mining.
I saw that, yeah. We'll touch on that at the end of the talk here, but keep going. Okay.
So what we did in that case was we then went out and found an investment partner to bring the capital to the project, right?
Sure.
And so we own part of it. We manage it and operate the site as Barefoot Mining, but then we have an investment partner, and we do this over and over and over again. So, you know, and what we do is usually in partnership with the investment partner or partners, mm-hmm. you know, we decide the parameters of the company. But basically, in all cases, what we do right today is every single month we create a P&L for that specific entity. And if we made, just say hypothetically, we had a profit of one Bitcoin in a given operation, and we owned 25% and the investors own 75%. Well, we're going to send them in Bitcoin. We're going to send them the 75%, and we're going to send ourselves back at Barefoot 25% of the Bitcoin. And so we do that for every site that we can. We've only done a press release on one of them, which you mentioned before, but we've actually done three of those this year. We have three more in process formally right now, and I have two more that I think are really close. So our hope is that we'll complete the year with 6 to 8 new of these, you know, little islands that are popping up, hopefully, actually all over the world, because we're trying to do some stuff outside the U.S. now too.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And okay, so out of all of these smaller companies that really just add up to Barefoot Mining, can you give me an overview of like the company makeup? Like, are you hiring specifically Bitcoiners? Are you hiring really anyone to get the job done? Just depending on the jurisdiction. What's the company culture like overall?
Yeah. Okay, great question. The first thing is we believe completely in operating within the ethos of Bitcoin. So we make the decisions about the expansion of the company by always asking, is what we're doing consistent with the best long-term interests of Bitcoin and the ethos? That something that helps us short term, but maybe in a fiat way or in some way that could weaken the Bitcoin ecosystem it's not going to pass muster. The people we hire have to buy into the ethos. Now, does that mean they have to be Bitcoiners? They typically are. If they're not Bitcoiners, then they probably have to be, they have to be like completely disassociated from everything else in crypto or whatever. So there are certain people who I think just carry forward a personal ethos that would be consistent. But to be straightforward about it, it's a hell of a lot easier to hire a Bitcoiner. in terms of, you know, hiring, yeah, it's a hell of a lot easier to hire a Bitcoiner. And so, it'd be hard for me to imagine in this day and age, somebody not being there. Now, as Bitcoiners know, you can be a Bitcoiner at all kinds of different levels.
Sure.
So, we get people at different stages of their journey, and that's okay. You know?
Yeah. What are the advantages of that, of hiring people aligned with your mission, understanding the technology itself, understanding the economic side? Why hire Bitcoiners compared to anyone else?
Well, first, what does the ethos teach us? You know, the ethos teaches us, I think, about honesty and truth and straightforwardness and transparency. Those are attributes that, even if you're not a Bitcoin company, I mean, if you're not hiring for those attributes, then you're probably in for a world of hurt. Mm-hmm. The second layer of that, though, are things like time preference. So, okay, our company is not trying to boil the ocean tomorrow. We have a long-term vision. We have a long-term vision for Bitcoin. We have a long-term vision for what we're going to do within Bitcoin. We all have a long-term vision for even what it does for us. And so I think an employee that takes the same approach is going to be a lot more successful because, you know, coming from the technology world, there are so many people that get accustomed to moving jobs frequently. They're chasing this big payday options. They're chasing salaries and bonuses. Like, there's all these things that are just kind of, they're so fiat-y, right? When you look back at it, just so fiat-y. And it's so unhealthy. I'm sure I'm going to upset some people, but I think that I look at Silicon Valley and I just see almost like a Roman sort of like misaligned incentives, people's whose value structures don't align properly. And I'm not saying we wouldn't hire somebody from Silicon Valley, but I think it'd be really hard for somebody to come out of that culture and come into our culture and be successful. They'd almost have to get fired. Like, I would love to hire the people who got fired from the big Silicon Valley companies because they were driven by a different set of incentives. My bet is those are the people that I'm going to like. And by the way, people, I felt this way when I was younger. Like, I was terrified of, like, being fired, you know, like I thought, oh, there'd be such shame and all that. Like, hell no. Yeah. I mean, if you got fired because you were stealing from the company or you didn't show up to work for 40, you know, that's one thing. Yeah. But, I guess there would be a dispute. Like when I finally left Gateway after a lot of years, there had been a big changeover at the top. And, I was running Gateway International at the time. And the CEO I had signed on with, Ted Waite, he had left. And there's a new CEO that came in and we were oil and water. And so he would say he fired me and I would say I resigned, but I really don't care.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of the fact that I was no longer associated with him. And by the history proved me right. I guess what I'm saying is, like, if you're ever out there and you get whacked, like, don't worry about it, man, you know, and embrace it. Like, you don't have to hide it. And if you go, if you're out talking to me someday or some other guy out there, you don't have to be ashamed of it. Just like I said, embrace it and you know, wear it as a badge of honor if you got whacked for the right reason, like, you know, because you were true to your virtues and true to your integrity and your beliefs. It's okay.
Sure. Yeah, I completely agree. It's tough putting yourself out there and owning up to that. But in the reality, it's all about the storyline. So even though you got laid off, you got fired for whatever reason, because the organization didn't align with you. Yeah, turn that into a story and prove to them that they made a mistake, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's shift over to hiring too for Barefoot. Curious, what are the most like in demand jobs for Bitcoin mining companies right now? And especially yours.
Well, I think that there's always going to be a need for people with, you know, technical capability. You know, this is very simple and straightforward. I'll give you the obvious answer and then the secondary answer.
Got it.
The first one is, yeah, I mean, if you know how to operate miners and mining centers and, you know, a lot of that, by the way, is just being inspired. If you love working with equipment, you love screwing around with firmware and tools like Foreman, which is a management tool, like all those sort of things. Mm-hmm. You know, we love those kind of people. They keep the engine running every day. Okay. The second kind of person that we need is really a hybrid person who can, I mentioned this before, you know, can you go find energy sources? Can you do the business development work to peel back the onion and make shit happen? Like I'll give you an example. This is one of our sites. This was not this year, it was previous year, but one of the members of our team found in an industrial park that we already had an operation in, had seen another company that was shutting down some of its facilities, completely unrelated, right?
Mm-hmm.
And realized that there must be some power coming offline as a result. And this was in an area where we already knew the rates were advantageous. So started asking around and found the landlord of the facility. Mm-hmm. And we actually didn't need the building. We just wanted the power, right? So I went to him and said, hey, we'll leave a little power for the building, which I think had been running like chillers and refrigeration equipment at a commercial scale. Like, let us put a couple containers on the backside of your building and you can still rent the space out for warehouse or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he did, you know, and so we were able to, and that was a 2-megawatt facility, by the way. So we ended up plopping 2 megawatts into what's now the backside of a burrito factory. It's now been turned into a burrito factory. And, you know, and nobody knows it's happening, right? I mean, we it's not the topic of today, but a typical Barefoot site, you won't know it's there. It's a couple containers sitting outside of a building and they just blend in with the rest of the infrastructure. And, but the reason I'm bringing that up is, you know, we need people that are aggressive, that will go find deals, go find partners, can present themselves to energy partners and investors. If they have some technical competency, wonderful, but it's not mandatory. Especially if they can speak the language of energy in the power world.
Yep.
But not mandatory.
Yeah. So someone listening right now, maybe coming from the traditional energy industry, piece of advice could be
just go out and start talking to people and find these locations, bring them to people like yourself, Bob, or other Bitcoin mining companies and say, hey, I have this deal. This seems like a pretty good idea. And I'm sure after a couple of conversations, that's how you get your foot in the door with the company eventually.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I'm sure you've done a ton of hiring in your career. What's one typical question you like to ask during interviews to screen for really anything?
You know, I don't know that it's a question, but I love the backstory. So, mm-hmm. You know, so if I'm hiring somebody and I'll give you an example. Let's say I'm hiring somebody in a technical position and something that typically would require an engineering degree. So if somebody walks in, two people walk in, person A has a bachelor's degree or master's degree from Stanford or MIT or some relatively prestigious place. That's great. No problem. But if the other person is from, let me think of it. Well, I'll use my school, which it's not a terrible school, but University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. It wouldn't be in your top 10 of engineering schools, right? Although I came out of there. So does the chairman and CEO of Microsoft came out of there as well out of the same program. But actually, which actually leads to my point that if I'm talking to these people and the person that came out of MIT, let's say, as an example, you know, came there because, I don't know, they got in because, I don't know, their dad was on the faculty or a big donor and like they didn't have to work to get in. And like, I'm not still saying I wouldn't hire them, but like those are, I don't want to know that you got out of MIT. I want to know, like, how did you get in? How did you get through it? What got you there? Because if it was like this silver spoon path, I really haven't had good luck with those people. You know, they come with the all the pedigree, right? But I haven't had good luck with them, frankly.
Yeah. On paper, it seems like the right decision.
Yeah, it's like it's too good. And I know this sounds terrible, maybe. And I'm sorry if you're out there and you have that and you really worked hard and you know your shit and you're you know, I'm not saying I wouldn't.
No, I think it's very insightful.
But the guy that, you know, has a 2.8 GPA from University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. I did better than that, by the way. I'm just hypothetical. but I wouldn't, it doesn't matter. If you had a 2.8 GPA, you took 6 years to get through. But I look at the resume and go, well, you know, why'd it take you 6 years? Well, in my freshman year, I got my girlfriend pregnant and then we got married and then I had to go to night school. And, you know, I was going to night school and I was working in this liquor store, you know, to make money. I go, well, that tells me a lot. It kind of goes to the same thing I said before. Like, don't be ashamed of you got fired. Don't be ashamed you got a 2.8 GPA. You got a story, man. You persevered. Like, you made it happen. That makes me really confident that you're going to appreciate the opportunity and you're going to work hard. You're not going to let simple obstacles, you know, just curtail your development personally or the development of the project you're on. So I want the backstory. So I know it's not a question, but like that's what I want to know. I want to know like that. So the moral of the story is I don't care if you went to MIT or Wisconsin, Milwaukee. I don't care if you got a 4.0 or a 2.8. I want to know how you got there. That's what matters to me.
Yeah, the story. I agree, too. Typically, people that don't take the easiest way through college, university, and a professional career, they build up some grit, I guess, too, and some hustle that you can't really do through the traditional path. So, yeah, I love that answer. And what about screening for Bitcoiners when you're hiring someone? Is there any questions you ask to see if they understand Bitcoin at some level.
Well, I think you can find out pretty quickly if they're sincere or not, you know, because that is a concern. So if somebody's coming to work at Barefoot Mining or something like that, obviously they know it's a Bitcoin company. So, you know, it's pretty easy to find out if they've read the key books. Are they on Twitter? Not all of these are prerequisites, right? But if you're, you know, if you haven't watched the Sailor series, if you haven't read the Bitcoin Standard, if you're not following on Twitter, if we can bring up some basics like, you know, what's a difficulty adjustment or some things like that. Now, obviously, it depends on the position, how important those things are. But you can separate it pretty quickly. The person that spent the evening before Googling as much as they could to get ready for a Bitcoin interview from from a Bitcoiner. There's a pretty easy, it's not that hard.
Yeah, I agree. And for me, like being a recruiter in the industry too, it's very easy for me to tell if someone gets Bitcoin, even at like the most basic level. When you start bringing up keywords like blockchain, crypto, even Web3, all of that, my BS meter automatically goes off, and then I start digging deeper into it. And the reality is a lot of Bitcoin companies, such as yourself, you said you want to hire Bitcoiners. So it's very important for anyone listening right now, make sure that you let the hiring manager know in the interview that you are a Bitcoiner. Make that very well known. And the story that led up to it too. Those all add into you eventually landing the job. So what's one piece of advice you give to someone listening right now that wants to come work in the Bitcoin mining industry and for any kind of position?
Well, I would say, you know, sincerity is absolutely imperative.
Yeah.
That, you know, only say things that you truly believe. If you don't know something, say you don't know something. That's a lot better, because like you said, like the bullshit meters are going to go off like right away. You can't bullshit your way out of you know, whether it's with me or, you know, any other person leading a company like this. I mean, you're not going to bullshit your way through it. So if it's like, hey, I don't know, it'd be better to say, you know what, I don't know a lot about Bitcoin, but what I've seen, I believe it's the future of money. And I want to be close to it. I want to learn everything about it. Like, okay, then, you know, hopefully that's true. We can ask some other questions to see whether or not that's really true. Yeah. The other thing I'll say, it's not exactly the question you asked, but I think it's worth stating, is I'm going to be 60 years old. My next birthday, I'll be 60. I for my whole life, I've always been learning that, you know, if you enter the Bitcoin world, but really this is true for everything, like you have to keep learning. Like, we talked about like degrees earlier. I mean, that's just a tiny beginning of your lifetime. If you want to rise to the top, if you want to run a company, you want to have a lot of success, like you got to learn your whole frickin' life. Yep. You have to be reinventing yourself continually. Hopefully that education you got, whatever it was, you know, gave you the base tools to keep learning. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm so blessed that I said I have a technical degree and I have a background in economics. So when I found Bitcoin, like, boom, it was probably easier for me than for a lot of people, because those things, just, you know, fortunate. But 6.5, almost 7 years into this journey myself, I'm still learning every night. a day doesn't go by. I mean, mm-hmm. To me, that's a gift. That's a blessing. It keeps me motivated. Another unsolicited thing, just a piece of advice I'll give is, never retire. Don't make your goals based on money. Number one, the money will come. Do something that serves the world and the money will come. And never retire. Seek financial independence. That's wonderful to do what it is that you enjoy doing, but don't try to retire. I tried that, by the way, at age 35, I had been through Gateway and the
35. That's stock a little
options. Yeah. I mean, I did well in that time period.
I'm sure you got bored.
I lasted 60 days. and I wouldn't even have lasted 60, except it was summer. And I had kids that were like grade school age kids at the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was basically a 60-day vacation. And then they went back to school. And I was like, well, now what am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
And so you realize that, you know, if you retire, like one definition of retirement is to be put out of service. And when you no longer serve something, then you become useless. Yeah. And I believe you die. I mean, and I believe you're probably going to die physically, but at a minimum, you die.
Mentally.
Deeply.
Yeah, I cannot agree more.
Yeah.
I'm pretty young, but I see people do that. Once they retire, they throw in the towel, even with like fitness too. When you stop working out and stop moving, your body dies.
Yeah.
So much quicker. Same with your mind too.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Cool. As we wrap this up here, Bob, I forgot to ask this before. What do you do day to day as the CEO of a Bitcoin mining company?
That's a good one. Well, I try my best to be strategic, that I have a great team and they keep the machines running. They make the gears of our operation run. And so, I try to stay out of that unless they need me. And I try to focus strategically. So what am I doing? I'm working on some of the stuff we talked about, which is identifying sites, identifying new opportunities. I'm trying to find ways to connect. I can only say certain things about this. I'm trying to connect what I do in mining to other pieces of the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
So, a lot of my effort right now is in, okay, we mine Bitcoin, but what can I do? How can I associate with other companies within the Bitcoin ecosystem that we have synergistic customer bases, or we have things that we can do as miners to serve them? I'll give you a simple example. Like Bitcoin miners create Bitcoin, right? I mean, at the end of the day, that's what we create. Well, there are other companies that need to buy Bitcoin and they need a guaranteed supply of Bitcoin to buy. So what can I do? Well, we don't necessarily have to take our Bitcoin and that we make and sell it to an exchange or other people we could sell it to, and we can cut out middlemen. So those would be just an example of the types of things we do. And then I believe that I have a responsibility to evangelize and educate. And I think good things come from that, that, you know, if it's talking to you today, but you know, if it's going on podcasts, if it's writing, I do my own material, if it's being on Twitter, that my set of my background is somewhat unique. I think that even for the head of a mining company, I don't know if anybody else has been a C-suite executive in a Fortune 200 company And most of the other guys, seems like a lot of people come out of the finance world, yeah, or and a couple from the energy world, mm-hmm, but I think I'm the only guy that I know of that came out of this. And I've seen so much, having been part of the personal computer industry and the internet, mm-hmm, a lot of things we talked about in our conversation, just I saw so much, I learned so much, I made a lot of mistakes, watch other people make mistakes in the growth of the personal computer industry. And I think, mm-hmm, the our industry, the Bitcoin industry, doesn't have the general population, I think, doesn't realize like how much change is going to occur in the next 5 years. Just use that as an example. But if you look at the personal computer industry as a model, if you look at 1990 and you compare it to 1995 or 2000, let's say that 5 to 10 year window, absolutely radical changes from, mm-hmm, who the number one PC company was, who the number five, you know, that like the list changed just absolutely radically. Much like, you know how the list of the top 10 cryptocurrencies, like if you look at that year over year, obviously, yeah, Bitcoin number one, but then you look at spots 2 to 10 and it's, yeah, all over the place, right? Year to year. Well, that's what's going to happen. When you look at who are the big companies within our world, whether it's the mining world or the whole ecosystem, it's going to change over radically. And you'll see companies fail. You'll see mergers. You'll see new companies come out of nowhere and explode. You'll see other companies come out of nowhere and turn into Amazon. It'll be a jaw dropping experience to see what happens.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I know I said I'd touch upon this too before we wrap up. Yeah. The Bitcoin Opportunity Fund and your new site as well. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about working with Bitcoin investors compared to traditional investors. What was that process like? Was it a lot easier for you to just go through the whole deal working with the people of the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund?
Much easier, mm-hmm, than a typical raise. And it's a, you know, it's a pleasure. First, you know, a lot of those guys are my peers. They age-wise, like, so, you know, James Lavish and Larry Lepard and Greg Foss and, like, you know, we're all old guys and we're friends. So that made it refreshing. I didn't have to orange pill anybody.
Right.
You know, measuring, this is an interesting thing. When you're trying to get a deal together, I try to look at the optics in Bitcoin. So we develop a pro forma for the business, and then we actually have the pro forma in both dollars and in Bitcoin, like, mm-hmm, so. And so if we're dealing with a traditional investor, they're always, they'll say things like, what's the IRR, internal rate of return? Mm-hmm. And they look at it much like they look at an apartment building, like an investment in an apartment building or a car wash. Mm-hmm. And I frankly, if they're, it's almost like the employee thing to a certain degree. I've gotten to where I prefer, like, really not to work with those people until they're orange pilled. And I'll help orange pill them.
Sure.
Maybe for a future deal. But, but you know, I want them to be in the position of evaluating as a Bitcoin opportunity. I mean, not that that's the name of that particular fund, but, yeah, you know, they have to, like, those guys who are all great guys and they all get Bitcoin equal to or more than me. Actually, I think what's really nice about that one, honestly, is we actually are all different. So, you know, that we're collaborating and talking about a lot of things beyond even that deal right now, but it's really a pleasure because, you know, we've all been around for a long time, but whether, you know, Foss was doing his things in bonds or Larry's doing his stuff in gold, or Lavish doing his stuff on Wall Street. You know, we can come together and see some things and offer insights that I think have hopefully we each have come out of it with more insight than we could ever get ourselves. And that's what I really hope for with these partnerships is, you know, I prefer them to be groups of people that will be more than just that deal, that be lots of deals over time. Yeah.
Yeah, I think working with other Bitcoiners, right, you get past that initial stage and you acknowledge that you're kind of both on the same foundation here. So that opens the door to other partnerships, whatever it may be, like you're saying. And I think as we're seeing more money come into the space, Bitcoin only VCs, funds like this, I think that's only going to accelerate. And yeah, I'm really excited to see what comes out over this decade here.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, there'll be some amazingly good things and there'll be some shocking failures.
Sure.
And, you know, and it's all part of the process. And, you know, I think, in the PC industry, you know, companies like Compaq, which those of you in Texas may remember a brand called Compaq, which was a huge brand in the late 80s. You know, they didn't make it out of the 90s. And they were the number one, they were number one in PC market share, by the early 90s, and by the late 90s, they were out of business. IBM actually just did, what did I do that? I did something recent. I think I did a little video on this one. But IBM went from inventing the PC in 1984, being number one in market share for 10 years until they lost it to Compaq, to being out of business in 2004. Those are pretty short periods of time when you look back at it. I mean, we saw that in our own industry. We saw Core Scientific go from the top of the mountain to bankrupt in a year.
Yeah. Well, Bob, thanks so much for your time today. I've learned a ton from you, and I love seeing seasoned veterans like coming from other industries now dedicating their careers to the Bitcoin space. That's awesome to see. And your evangelism too. I think that's very important in the space. So thank you for all that. How can the audience get in contact with you and find Barefoot Mining online?
Barefoot Mining is just barefootmining.com. So that's simple. There are ways to reach us, whether you're an investor, an energy provider, there's different tabs. I see most of those, by the way. Anybody serious about it, you can contact me, bob.burnett@barefootmining.com. I do my very best to respond to everything. I'm on Twitter at boomer_BTC. And then we've got a couple different podcasts we do, one called Mind Your Business and one called Old Man Yells.
Is that you?
And that was just me rambling on. So if you didn't get enough of me rambling on today and you want to hear more of it, go to Old Man Yells. So
sounds good. All right. Well, you guys know where to find Bob. Thanks again, Bob. Hopefully talk to you soon.
Thank you, Eric.
Hey guys, thanks for listening. And I really hope you found value in this podcast. If you're a job seeker looking to work for a Bitcoin company, or you're a part of a Bitcoin company and need help with finding talent for your team, please head over our website at www.bitcointalent.co and get in touch with our team. Thanks. Until next time.